Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Japan's greatest victory, Britain's worst defeat, the capture of Singapore in 1942, Colonel Matsuyoshi mastermind behind it, and author of this book. And we're probably up to the 30th episode, and we're getting really towards the very last death throes of the Australian Army against the Japanese. Okay, and this is, well, basically it's the Australian Army. To the heights of the Imperial Palace. That's 47, chapter 47. In determining the position from which the Army headquarters could exercise supreme command of the battle to decide the destiny of Japan and the emancipation of Asia, there are many aspects to be considered, but notwithstanding the risk involved, we chose the heights of the Imperial Palace, Ishihachi, or Green Palace. It was an obvious target for enemy plans, but it possessed such an outstanding advantage of observation and signal communications that we decided as it, the headquarters should be. The Sultan of Johor had built the Imperial Palace regardless of expense, boasted of its beauty's majestic appearance. It stood on the heights on the north side of the Johor Strait looking down on Singapore Island. It was in easy range of enemy artillery, and at times even machine gun bullets came flying past, for the enemy lines were no more than 2 kilometres distance from the palace, and the naval port of Sakai lay beneath one's eyes. The Tenkai aerodrome appeared as if it could be grasped in the hand. It was our only infantry front line that was also forward of artillery observation post. There was reasonable and genuine opposition to the occupation of the palace as army headquarters. Many believed it was too exposed to enemy fire to be used by the army. Divisional headquarters felt strongly the army had stolen a march on them. It was, however, the only position for which the army commander could have a close view of the whole battle line from the crossings of Horse Strait to the capture of the heights of Bakutema. The spiritual effect alone of being able to see every detail of the battle was sufficient importance to override all oppositions, which was strong even among the members of the staff. Which is rather interesting because there's the idea of this flying samurai. He flew over at the start. This is Colonel Tsuji. The army commander's decision ended all discussions, and there was a minimum number of staff personnel necessary to push forward to the palace, while the rest remained at the rear of the rubber jungle. Although the palace stood in an exposed position, the unanimous opinion was, quote, anyhow, if we die, we will not the heights of the Imperial Palace be a suitable place. Standing on an excellent lawn, the red brick and green tiled building, whose splendid appearance the Sultan was so proud, was perfectly visible to the enemy. Shells sometimes fell on the lawns, turning up the earth and leaving craters like pitted pock scars. At the eastern end of the building, there was a 5-story observation tower with a narrow spiral iron ladder leading up to the top. There was a 4.5 mat room, whatever that means, glassed on all sides. It gave the impression of a small castle town. A warship has a steel conning tower, but there we had a glass-covered battle command post. Struck by stray enemy bullets, several of the glass windows were smashed. But although not constructed for warfare, the building was strong and powerful. We decided to use the glass-enclosed room for military observation rooms, and for about a week we practically confined there, making preparations for the attack. With field glasses, the movement of every individual man over the entire enemy side of the strait could be clearly seen. In this observation post, we drafted the army commander's first telegram, quote, I, this whole day, pushing forward the command post to the heights of the Johor Imperial Palace, will observe directly the strenuous effort of every divisional commander, signed Lieutenant General Yoshimita. Thus, under hostile shellfire, army headquarters gave silent encouragement to officers and men of the whole army. Normally there are numerous arrivals and departures from army headquarters, and many people disregard the regulations for preserving concealment and privacy. In this place, however, there was no traffic, for visitors to headquarters came at the risk of their lives of enemy fire. The staff practically lived on dry bread and tinned food, and no one account was cooking allowed. While we lived together, the Army Artillery Unit Observation Post, enemy shells sometimes flew over the heights, but the glass-covered observation room towering in the sky was a practical safety zone. When the enemy surrendered, we inquired
Why did you not sell the heights of the Imperial Palace? The reply was, it was not thought that under any circumstances such a distinct building would be used as army headquarters. Up to the last, the most suitable military operation command post and our use of it was completely surprised the enemy.
Okay.
Chapter 48, Distressing Preparations. Concealment of the plan for invading Singapore Island was absolutely necessary. The main army forces and vehicles of all descriptions, except patrols, guards, and staff necessary preparation for crossing the water barrier, were protected from enemy observations by rubber jungles in positions suitably isolated from Johor Strait. In accordance with the plan, all inhabitants within approximately 20 kilometres of the strait were inhabited. Enemy patrols and spies who were disguised and used small radio transmitters and single shots were difficult to distinguish from the civilian population. We had to avoid killing innocent people by fire and sword. The columns of refugees removed from the houses in which they lived for so many years, irrespective of age, sex, and their personal possessions over their shoulders, moved out slowly. 5 or 6-year-old girls with squat bottles of drinking water hanging from their shoulders, pulled along by their mother's hands, were jostled along the line, seeing them trudging barefoot along the hot asphalt road, thinking of one's own children left behind in the fatherland. It was difficult to view this as a matter of military necessity, but there was no alternative but to avert our faces and steel our hearts against compassion. We knew that hardships of the refugees would be over in a short time. In the meantime, we could keep as many people by giving them transport in empty trucks that were returning northward. In about a week, In about a week, every detachment working almost to exhaustion had completed preparation. The principal task of carrying out accurate artillery survey, amending existing defects in our maps, exactly plotting enemies' positions on them was satisfactorily executed. Other things which had to be undertaken were calculating the necessary data for artillery ranges, the accumulation of ammunition to complete the full quantity required per gun, preparation by engineers for crossing the strait, the overhaul of the boat equipment, an important matter, and cutting down the jungle and opening up the roads for troop concentration at points at the water's edge. The Corporal Staff Officer Hongo, Railways, the Staff Officer Kato, Ammunition, Staff Officer Kara, Boat Preparation, Staff Officer Cedar and Kimusek, the attack preparations of each division, and Staff Officer Sugita, Intelligence, all watching enemy movements and giving full attention to their tasks, had not a moment's leisure. Especially diligent was the railway unit, which had prepared 1,100 kilometres of rail and had badly damaged by the retreating enemy up the boundary of Johor Strait. This had been completed by the end of January, and within another week, the full requirement of ammunition per gun was being accumulated. The work was completed as a result of supreme effort, and the spirit permeated all our troops on the lines of communication. Motor traffic reached the limits of congestion, thrusting forward with supplies for each army division. Every artillery unit near the front line and the northern extremity of the Johor Strait, in all probability, nearly 3,000 motor vehicles were used. The central east coast roads were restricted to two outwards and return journeys, respectively, and in Sidkai, in the southern movement, was permitted only by night. Traffic was strictly controlled, since violation of the rules laid down could obstruct the preparation of the whole army. Control, however, was not easy. The commander of the tank brigade organized all the movements of motor vehicles, which were kept in order by numerous traffic control squads. A surprising amount of labour was saved by the engineers' preparation for the crossing of the strait. Selected officers, non-commissioned officers, and men supervised by day and night worked, the work carried on at the water's edge inside the jungle, warding off attacks by crocodiles, watching enemy movements on the opposite shore, hourly investigating conditions of constantly changing tidal currents, and measuring the depth of water as many points as possible. One party reconnoitred the presence of obstacles on the opposite shore in order to indicate secretly the road to be followed by the main forces moving into position. The fuel stored in Singapore was a quantity equivalent to 6 months' supply of the whole British fleet. If after we commenced the channel to the enemy deliberately and without warning opened oil feeds the pipes into streams inside the island onto the waters of the strait and ignited it, the battlefield would be transformed to a sea of fire. From the commencement of the operation, this possibility greatly worried General Ishita, who during this visit to Germany had been told of such occurrence by a German general. Staff officers repeatedly experimented with drums of oil thrown into the water and small ponds on our lines and smooth water. It certainly appeared possible that the surface of the water could be set afire. On the Johor Strait, however, the rise and fall of the tide and strong current would not be easy to cover the whole surface of the oil, nor did we consider it seriously how to cope with the situation. Nevertheless, to lessen the possibility of the enemies attempting to set the waters of the strait afire, all tanks were immediately attacked and destroyed by heavy artillery bombardment. The whole island was hidden with black smoke, which hampered us to a great extent, for it prevented observation of the fall of our shells, either from the ground or the air. One problem was to protect our main forces crossing the strait from the attack from enemy gunboats. This duty was given to the right wing of the 18th Division. One section of artillery was placed in a concealed position at the water edge and laid its guns to fire low across the surface so they could secure direct hits on any small craft following their line of fire. Large crafts were also built with which to block the entrance of the strait and obstruct any vehicles attempting to enter it. The preparations were completed in about a week. The hardships experienced by the officers and men during the preparatory period were not less than those in the battlefield. Army orders demanded that all preparations should be completed by noon the 5th of February, but except for the artillery, no reports of preparation had been completed that had received by that time. In reply to an urgent telephone call, the division answered, quote, "We will finish without fail by the evening of the 7th. The army commander, however, after mature consideration, decided to postpone the attack by one day. No division, of course, made any comment on this decision, but there was little doubt they were all very pleased with the extra time given. The postponement was typical of General Yoshida's consideration for those of his orders, which marked him as a commander of outstanding qualities. All preparations having been completed and reconnaissance reports synthesized without necessitating any alteration whatsoever in the army plan, everything was now ready for the attack. The commanders under Kanuki Imperial Guards, who had directed to carry out the demonstration on X-1 day and cross the Johor Strait in the rear of the 5th Division on X-1 day and the evening, was, however, not satisfied. He wanted the division to join the first attack and suggested to the army commander to the desirability of amending one section of the army's order in which were on the point of being issued to enable him to do so. General Yoshida revised the orders accordingly, and this matter later gave rise to serious problems. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.